You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here to my right, we've got Martin Page.
Hey, Mike.
Next to him, we've got Bobby Summerfield.
Hello, Mike.
That's like two in a row, Bobby.
That is.
Next to him, we've got Scott Gershon.
Hello, Mike.
Next to him, across the table, we've got Andrew Sheps.
Happy New Year, Mike.
And next to him, we've got Rob Arbiter.
Hello, Mike.
Guys, this is the second show in a row where everybody is here.
Yay!
So, Rob, how many teeth did you lose?
Oh, we got to go right into that? If I sound a little funny tonight, it's because I just had four really badly impacted wisdom teeth removed a few days ago. So tonight's show is also sponsored by Vicodin.
But compared to doing revisions, it was nothing.
So, but you know what? He's keeping his streak alive, though.
You haven't missed a podcast?
Haven't missed a podcast. Guys, this is number 20.
Wow.
20. Well, before we get going, I would like to introduce once again a friend of the podcast, Marvin Caesar from Apex. Marvin is here because Apex and the Audio Nowcast are now going to be friends. Apex has generously agreed to sponsor the Audio Nowcast. And Marvin, welcome.
Thank you, Mike. And thank you for inviting me.
Well, we appreciate you sponsoring our show here. We did a show with Apex, and I got a lot of, that show sounded so great. That show sounded really good. So after that show, when we used all the Apex gear, we had to get Apex to come and help us out.
Absolutely.
Well, why don't you tell a little bit about the processors that we're using for the Audio Nowcast.
What we're all using, except for two gentlemen from across the pond.
I wonder why the English get
We're all using us rebs.
We got Neve, actually.
We're using the Apex 230, and that's a voice processor. That's a combination of the tube preamplifier, Easy Rider compressor, logic assisted gate, de-esser, oral exciter, big bottom, EQ, and A to D. So it's all in one. And the real benefit of it, you're listening to right now. And the second benefit is that when people go to post it, there's not a lot of work to do.
Yeah, that's the most important thing. There's not a lot of work to do. As a matter of fact, if you really want to hear the 230 at its best, Andrew, why don't you step up to the microphone?
Apparently, I sound quite good this week.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Spiritual stuff.
Look at that. All he needs to do is
a couple
babies and
cows. Don't sound that good. This is not Apex.
So, we're excited to have Apex here, and thank you very much, Marvin. Appreciate you.
It's my pleasure
sponsoring the podcast, and you know, pretty soon it's going to sound even better when we get everybody on, 230s. Well, guys, I hope you had a really good holiday season. Did everybody get what they wanted for Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever you celebrate?
Did you, Mike? Did you get what you wanted?
I did, as a matter of fact.
Good.
We spent all that time talking about the perfect gifts. Mm-hmm. Did you receive any perfect gifts, Mike?
I actually got a really great perfect gift. I've got a MacBook Pro 17-inch.
Ooh.
And let me tell you, the best thing about that is boot camp, because I used to have to carry a PC and I used to have to carry a Mac. And now I've got a Mac that is a PC or a PC that is a Mac. Yeah. And it really works really well.
Just imagine when you get your iPhone with that, mate, you'll be really hip.
Just be ready
in time to go online and buy a new Vista.
Yeah, new Vista. No, but it works really well. I haven't tried out too many audio applications on it yet because I've been playing games on my Mac, which is something you could never do before, the boot camp. But it's been really cool, and it hasn't crashed on me. The only annoying thing about the MacBook Pro is the fan for the graphics card just sounds like a jet. I mean, when it kicks in, it's, you know, don't plan on recording in the same room that you have a MacBook Pro in, because it just sounds like a vacuum cleaner in the other room. So it's really loud. Wow. So anyhow, yeah, that was my...
Bootcamp, by the way, works really well on a G. My mate's doing some mastering for me. And we're running all on PC, XP, Bootcamp, WaveLab, Nuendo, and Renamer. They'll work great.
Yeah, because it 100%. Turns your computer into a PC. It's really cool. It's really easy to toggle between the two. And I did a lot of research between that and another system called Parallels. I don't know if you know that, where it runs within OS X, and you can run your Windows operating system inside OS X. But the only problem for me is, especially if you're doing audio or you're doing any kind of video editing where it has to have, you know,
access
to the hardware, you just want the machine to be what it is. So it's really cool. So I've got, you know, SoundForge and Pro Tools.
The only thing we found is we had to buy a PC keyboard and PC mouse because the Mac mouse kept disconnecting, the USB mouse.
Oh, you know what? I use Bluetooth. I have a Bluetooth mouse because it's a MacBook Pro, and so far, so good. Knock on wood.
Don't hit my head.
Did I mention I had four Bluetooth removed? Did I mention that?
And I recorded all the screaming.
That would have been awesome. Well, guys, I want to introduce to you over at the end of the table there. It's a very long
table. This is apparently a huge table.
Our guests today are Steve Jay and his son Miles. And Steve plays bass for Weird Al Yankovic. And Miles plays bass for Weird Al Yankovic. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourselves and introduce yourself there, Steve.
Okay, Mike. Yeah, like you said, I play bass for Weird Al. We started the band in 81. It's pretty much been the same band since 1981. We've swapped keyboard players a few times, but other than that, it's the same rhythm, guitar, bass, and drums.
Well, keyboard players are disposable anyhow.
Right, Rob?
Oh, yeah.
Sure are. Yeah, and there have been some times when I had other gigs, and so Miles is also a bass player, and he's risen to the challenge and gone out on the road with Al. And he's also recorded some tracks with Al, because Miles specializes in string bass, which I don't play, so whenever that's called for.
So together we're a complete bass player.
That's great.
So the question is, when you're on the road, do you both have to share the same bunk, or do you get that?
Well, we haven't both been on the road.
If I can be the new keyboard player, maybe we'll both go on the road.
Well, Steve also is a composer that I have. I actually met him when we were both doing some educational things for PBS. So I've known Steve for about 10 years. Welcome.
Thanks.
The first thing I want to get into, can you tell us and the listening audience a little bit about how do you do such, you know, your production? How do you capture the songs as well as you do? Do you get access to the tracks, or do you just have to listen on a CD and basically just study each little part? How does that – talk us through a little bit about the process of recording Weird Al's parodies that he does.
Yeah, well, we never use original tracks. It's always new stuff. And we started off in the beginning when we found out that we could make a living doing this. We decided to really dedicate ourselves to doing the best we could at basically paying tribute to a bunch of great tracks that have been recorded. It's easy to record them again, so we try to make sure that we do them justice and maybe take them up a notch if possible. But basically, since it's been the same band for so long, everyone is sort of his own department. Like, I'm the low frequency department, our guitar player does his thing, and our drummer does his thing, and we always have analyzed the tracks to the nth degree, go out and buy whatever equipment we need that was used on the track, or sometimes we'll call up the original artist to ask what particular type of bass it was or something, and try and get, you know, exactly the same sound that they had. A couple times we've gotten some players, like Mark Knopfler played guitar on the Money for Nothing parody, and Dweezil Zappa played guitar on a Frank Zappa thing we did recently as guest musicians. But the rest of the time it's just us.
Have you ever found any sound that's just been unbelievably hard to try to replicate? I mean, has there been any part of some song where you're thinking, how in the world did they do that?
Yeah, the snare drum sound on the Fine Young Cannibal song, She Drives Me Crazy.
Yeah.
I think it was like a squashed paper cup or something. I don't know what that was, but they had a lot of trouble finding that one. Yeah, Al goes to great extremes, you know. Well, everybody in the band does to find these sounds.
And when you are in the studio, about how long does it take for you to tackle each tune? Is there, do you find, you know, a week or two, or is it usually like you just get in there and you can do it over a weekend for a song just to get the basic tracks down? I mean, how does that, what's the process like on actually the recording?
Uh-huh. Well, the albums are half originals. And a lot of people don't know that, but half the songs on the album are. So we usually do the originals first, like 6 months or 8 months before an album's to be released. So we have those in the can. And then he starts writing the parodies, and we start studying the tracks that are on the original song that the parody is a parody of. And we record those one by one until we get them done, and then usually wait for the last perfect parody to come along, because there's a huge element of timeliness with these things. If he doesn't get permission to do a parody when the parody's hot, then of course it isn't that much that funny, you know. So on this last album, he had permission retracted a couple of times, so we had to switch songs after we had recorded one and wait for the next one to come along. Luckily, we got a good one. But the way the process goes, usually we just, as far as the originals go, we usually record demos at a small studio, sometimes at my place. We do it and get it all worked out and then bring it to the studio and usually lay down all the rhythm tracks, bass, and drums in a day. And then he starts the overdubs. That usually takes a couple of days for six songs. And then he works on his vocals for maybe a week or so, and we come back and do vocal tracks. With the parodies, since they've already been recorded and there's not a lot of decisions to be made, we usually record all the tracks in a couple of days, you know, except if there's a big orchestra or something involved.
Since this is the Audio Nowcast, tell us a little bit about your home studio. What do you use?
Well, I'm using Cubase.
Cubase.
Still using Cubase.
Hello. Now, have you heard of, there's a program called Pro Tools. Would you ever use it?
Yeah, I've used it.
Have you used it? But for sequencing, is it even, do you even switch it on? Oh, sorry, carry on. I digress.
Well, I don't happen to have it right now.
No, nor do I, actually. Fine.
The thing is, what I mostly do is write, and Cubase just works for me. Yeah, it just, exactly. It's so transparent and quick, I haven't felt the need to change. Miles has been working in Cairo recording a lot on Pro Tools, so he keeps bugging me to get it for our studio, and we will. But we just don't have it yet.
What have you been doing in Cairo, Miles?
Well, spending the last 2 years of my life looking for something that I still haven't quite found, but on a musical adventure. I graduated from college, and it's sort of, well, I had a big interest in Arabic music, and I figured the next step was to go to the Middle East and spend a month or two and see the situation and the culture and the people surrounding the music. And after 2 months, I realized it was far too little time. So I extended for two, and then progressively I was always living there for 2 more months for about 2 years. And I just came home about a month ago.
Wow.
So I'm a bass player, acoustic bass player, and this time when I went back, it was in 2 1-year trips, I brought a Mac laptop and the FirePod, Cubase, and recorded 2 albums with a Lebanese record producer of ensembles that I co-founded in Cairo. So, adventure leaves off there. The next chapter is unwritten.
After high school, I just went to Disney World.
That's great.
Wow. That's great. What was it like playing for Weird Al the first time you took your dad's place? How was that?
Yeah, it was really funny because all my life I had been watching my dad learn these parts just like he described to you. And I was on the couch either playing with my Legos when I was real small or playing with my short scale bass he got me when I was around 10. And then 1 year I was doing it for real, basically. It, you know, some circumstances came up and he needed a sub for about 2 weeks of shows in California. So I got my shot and I had a great time.
Do you ever get anybody come to you and say, Jay, you're looking like 25 years younger. What happened to you?
Oh, man. That was the plan.
Yeah. He goes and picks up the chicks and he cleans up.
That's right. Yeah, I'm Steve Jay. You'll see me around the back.
I'm already there.
Well, that's great.
That's a good deal. Eh?
That's great. Now, Steve, right now you guys are in pre-production for the tour. And how's that coming along?
Just great. We got about 10 more rehearsals, and then we hit the road, start off in Auckland and do Australia, and then do the rest of the States and up until fall, I guess. That's going great. It's going to be a great show. Lots of songs. Seems like there's about 100 songs in it. Sometimes we hit them just for a verse and a chorus and do these big, long medleys, you know, but it's really a lot of fun being the bass player and getting lots of backup harmony parts to sing that are usually in some sort of contrary motion with oblique rhythms to where you have to really triangulate yourself to do them both at the same time.
That's right, because we were talking yesterday and you were telling me about having a hard time well, not a hard time, because I won't say you were having a hard time.
Definitely having a hard time. Until I practice.
You were playing one thing and you're having to sing another part. And tell me a little bit about what we were talking about and how you use Cubase to help you learn your parts.
Oh, yeah. It works like a charm. Well, Al really expects a lot of us vocally, and it's great that he does, because it's really fun to sing and play at the same time. But a lot of times I'm playing some, you know, dotted 16th pattern in the bass and trying to sing triplets on top in, you know, harmonies that'll switch from fifth to third to octave all the way through. And so reading it off of a chart, it's kind of like you're just never quite there if you're always thinking ahead, you know, what's that next thing going to be, you know. And so what I do is I take the whole set and record all my bass parts and record all my backup vocal parts and then just practice with that. So if it's a 10 or 15 minute medley of maybe 20 or 30 songs, I just sort of learn it as a song in itself, to where it just, as I'm playing, that part just comes to my head because that's the way I've been hearing it without any other parts, just like it would be coming out of my monitor. And then where the tricky parts are, where I have to really concentrate on doing two strangely different things at once, I just stick it in the repeat mode in Cubase to where it'll just loop itself around. And what I found in doing that, it's so great, as opposed to sitting with a CD player and deciding, oh, I need to do that again and hitting rewind and, you know, play again, where you're always making the decision consciously that you have to do it again. This way it just keeps doing it, and eventually you just feel like, okay, I've had enough. I certainly know this by now, and you move on. And then when those parts come up, instead of it being involving any concentration at all, it's just like super, super easy. So you can enjoy yourself on stage.
I've always admired people who could play and sing, especially when they're not.
Especially some bass player.
Yeah, well, Martin King. Well, I was going to say, Martin, you know, on the road, you know, you were singing one part and you're playing a totally another part. I mean, how do you get that in sync?
That was a mistake,
how
does that?
it's the same way, really. I think it's a matter of just, you know, really practicing and trying to split your brain down the middle. And I would do the same thing. I would learn the bass part extensively so I didn't really have to think about it. And then I would just concentrate on singing. And then before you know it, you're not thinking about playing the bass. It was interesting playing reggae. I found that the toughest because you're going against the groove a great deal and there's huge gaps. And it was for me as a songwriter, if you've written the song, though, it's a little bit easier. I'd imagine for what you were saying with Weird Al, that it's, you know, you're learning stuff that you're not really so common with. I can imagine that's harder. But for me, because I wrote the songs, it was a little easier. But, you know, it was quite funny on the last album because I would record the bass always separately from the vocals. And then when I had to tour and learn it, it was like, bloody hell. Why did I make the bass so complicated? Yeah. But after a while, you aren't even thinking about it, are you? You know, yeah, you're just not thinking about it. It's all mechanical. It's just happening. Yeah.
Except every now and then when you forget a chorus during the show live. And
I never did that, Mike. Okay. Never. No. I think it was... No, uh-huh. No. Yeah. I'd never make mistakes.
Okay, yeah.
Where was that? Cleveland?
Oh, I don't know.
I used to play with Joe Higgs, too, so I know what you're talking about with the reggae thing.
Yeah.
And singing.
Yeah. Another world, isn't it?
Really floating.
Yeah.
So now that you're getting ready for the new tour, why don't you tell us a little bit about your rig that you're going to be using on the road, your bass rig? Let me get all the technical stuff out of the way. So.
Oh, okay. Well, if I could use a bass rig, I'd be using my Mackies powered cabinets, 1530s. I got like four of the big ones and two of the small ones because it just gives a great clear sound and it's foolproof and they work like a charm. I used to use Mesa Boogie D180, get a little bit of distortion for that kind of a sound, but now so many of the parts, I'm imitating a synthesizer. Sometimes I'm playing 8 or 12 string, and I need a lot of clarity in the bass, so I just use these pre-powered cabinets.
Yeah, because that would, my next question is I'm, with your whole band, you need to get so many different sounds for so many different genres for, you know, all the different music. I mean, that just must be a challenge in and of itself.
Yeah, well, I found one device that works really well in general for getting a lot of different bass sounds, and I've pretty much stuck with that for...
Which is?
It's the Korg Toneworks AX30B.
That's it, folks. That's the secret right there.
Yeah, I got it a long time ago, and then it burned out, and I had to find a new one on eBay because none of the new stuff that was out was quite delivering all the different sounds I needed for the songs we were doing, but that thing does the job.
And what bass guitar do you play?
Well, on this tour, I'm mostly going to be playing Warwick and Alembic and Dean. I have a slew of them to choose from, but I've kind of neglected my Warwick a little bit, and I'm looking forward to spending a lot of time with it, you know, and the Alembic, too.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Have you guys ever been to anybody seen Weird Al live? Have you seen Weird Al
live?
Never.
Time to time.
Yeah, Miles, I'm sure you have.
But you started asking about my bass rig. Yeah. That's what I would use if I could, but I don't because everyone uses in-ears except me.
Oh.
I've never used in-ears because it just doesn't – I don't get the immediate feeling of the bass or the feeling of the bass, so I've always liked to hear, you know, the sound of the room. So I go with two wedges, you know, really good quality wedges, and everyone else is in-ear. So that means that I can have whatever mix I want in the wedges, and it's not interfering with what they're hearing. And I have them mix it to complement the room sound, so it's really exquisite for a bass player to be on stage where everyone is in-ear except you, because you can have the stage sound basically just like you want it to, you know, with lots and lots of kick drum and plenty of your vocals and just a little of everyone else to know where you're at, you know.
Wow, so you don't have to compete with, like, yeah, the guitar right. player or any of the other monitor mixes out
yeah,
there.
Yeah, it's like I'm in an ISO booth on the stage, other than the backwash, you know, and yeah. dealing yeah. with all of that. But
and it's strange to sing with in-ears, isn't it? It's weird.
Yeah, I like them for singing.
Yeah, it's
great.
Weird, right? You feel like very, very, like, you're scared of yourself. You go, oh, Jesus, me.
Yeah. Yeah,
kind of
thing. Yeah, but to tell you the truth, also, that plugging in and having something connected to the back of your head and going back and yeah. we do a lot of costume changes, just that feeling of being dependent on these okay. instead of your ears. I just love having my ears open and being in the room, you know.
Well, the reason why I asked if anybody's seen Weird Al, because Weird Al puts on a great show. I mean, the shows.
Well, I don't know. I don't have the schedule.
And one thing I've noticed and is not only does he put on a great show, but he really has a lot of characters that follow Al around. I mean, why don't you tell us a little bit, some of the stories, if you want, about some of the people that have you know, that you see over... over.
Oh, man. How do I handle that? Well, but I don't know. I can only say that when somebody shows you the new tattoo on their ankle that they got of your face... And then you see it on some TV special about weird tattoos. And there you are on a tattoo, on an ankle, on television.
Wow. Wow, that's a new one.
You didn't know about this?
No.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, one time this person had a sign his ankle, each of the four band members on a different side, and then the next year he came back with full 8-inch tall color images of us tattooed above the autograph.
What's odd about that?
Wow, that's amazing. You know, when your band gets fanatical. Cult status, you know, all kinds of weird things happen out there. That's just bizarre.
Yeah, but the people really love it. It's a great thing being on stage with him. It's like you're on stage with Elvis and Santa Claus and who knows. I mean, they just...
What is his history? I mean, I don't know much about him, I'll be honest. I mean, I know of him, but I haven't heard from him for a while. And I'm dumb, mm-hmm. obviously.
Yeah, well, we started the band in 81 right after he released Another One Rides the Bus.
Okay.
And that he just recorded on a cassette, on a regular audio cassette in a bathroom at the radio station at the college where he worked. Just stuck it on a cassette and played it on his accordion, sang it, and sold, I think, 100,000 singles. And
that's amazing.
And then went on to get a deal, and the first few albums weren't all that big, and then all of a sudden Eat It was the big hit.
Okay.
And then that propelled us on for the next 10 or 15 years or so.
I remember Like a Virgin was one.
Yeah, that was another big one.
That was a big one, too.
But now this new album, after all these years, is his biggest one ever. Because it entered the Billboard charts at number 10.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, we had never even gone up that high before, so.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was really lucky.
What is his background?
Okay, well, let's see. He grew up in Linwood, California, played accordion, and went to college in San Luis Obispo. Studied architecture, and then while he was a campus DJ, he did that Another One Rides the Bus thing.
Brilliant.
And it all started.
Good for him. That's brilliant. That's
yeah.
fun. That's,
it's had its ups and downs, but yeah, kind of a project that was fun to do one summer. None of us thought that it would be a gig for so long. But it's nice being with the same band for that many years. It's really a unique opportunity.
Yeah. And you guys are tight. I mean, you are tight as a drum.
We should be.
No, I'm just amazed, especially some of the melodies that you do, and just, you know, especially the angry rock polka .
I guess the last time was the angry white boy polka.
Yeah, that was it. That was excellent. That was really great. Well, I'll tell you what, we're gonna take a break right now, and then
get a tattoo. I was gonna get.
Yeah, that's right. Well, actually, I got Martin's already. I'm gonna get yours.
I know where
next
that is too. And it says his full name, doesn't it? Certain times of the day.
There goes the iTunes.
Hey, that's where.
Yeah, we need a break. All right, so we'll see you guys on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by AFEX and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And yeah, we were talking with Stephen Miles J. from Weird Al Yankovic. And boy, he's had a great career. It was so good to see this last album, how just popular it came out. You know, White Nerdy just took off as soon as it hit the net. That was just really exciting.
Really? Amazing.
I mean, what was Al? Was he just totally just blown away by how – what was his expectations, or what was the whole band's expectations this time through?
Well, we had a good feeling from the record company. So they said they were going to really be pushing it. And Al kept talking about how he was amazed at all the promotion they were putting in, but we still hadn't recorded the big parody. And Al had done one where we recorded it, and then the permission was retracted, and so he felt kind of lost. He had to find something quick, and then another one came along, and it didn't work out. And then at the last minute, the song Driving Dirty came up, which he did White and Nerdy to, and it was just a stroke of fortune, because it's such a funny song. There's so many lyrics in it. It's really fast singing, so he has to pack a lot of jokes into a really short song, and it just went through the roof, number one on iTunes. And
yeah, it was great. The first time, have you guys seen it?
Yeah, it's hilarious.
It is. Martin, you got to get out more often.
I know, man.
It really is. It's really funny, and it was perfect.
It's on the internet. You got to stay in more.
What's the internet?
A special podcast
just for me to be educated.
So yeah, I was just really amazed that, you know, after all this time, he's still even more popular. And you know, my daughter, she's 13, and her friends are just, you know, it's like they're discovering Weird Al, you know. And it's just, you almost get a little bit of that whole Beatle thing, you know, where these different generations start discovering, you know, music and more music and more music, and it just keeps going on.
Oh yeah, we get people at our shows who say, you know, I was a fan when I was a kid, and now I bring my grandchildren to your show.
That's great.
That makes you feel young.
Really? Makes you feel eternal.
Well, hey, guys. I'm going to change the topic here for a little bit, because this week in Anaheim, there's a big show going on, the NAMM show. First of all, Rob, are you going to be there? Are you showing?
I'm going to be there.
Where, are you going to be in the Steinberg?
I'm going to be in the Steinberg booth. Demoing Cubase.
Yeah.
Cubase.
I've been a Cubase user for a really, really long time.
And who introduced you to Cubase?
I believe that would be Scott Martin Gershon.
Oh, thank you very much.
So do you have anything, any trailers or anything you're going to be playing for Cubase?
Actually, this show I'm going to be showing a lot of virtual instruments. So I found my most successful demos at the NAMM show are if I just set up a big arsenal of instruments and just write something in the booth. So I'll just generally sit there, and either with picture or without picture, I'll just call up rhythm section sounds and just write a new composition in the booth. People like it because it's an honest demo. It's basically showing the way I use the software every day anyway. And it's really easy for me because it's basically the exact same thing I'm doing at home if I'm working.
You know, getting paid for it.
Well, more or less.
You know, last year, I saw one of your demos, and you wrote the funkiest piece in 10 minutes. It was just amazing. I was sitting there, and I was with Larry, and we were like...
That's right.
It was like, man, you know, it was really good. So,
I mean, for me, it's the perfect demo because it's something I'm very comfortable doing. I've done it a zillion times, and it requires zero preparation, which is how much time I have, because I'm going to be in a session... the show is in 2 days. Tomorrow night, I'm going to work till about 1 a.m., and then I'm going to drive down to Anaheim, pass out at a hotel, and then be ready for the show early Thursday morning. So I don't have any time to prepare, and luckily this demo doesn't require it. I'm just going to have my Vicodin and my virtual instruments. And I'll be all set.
What can one want? Version 2, V2.
Wow.
That's all I need.
Those demos are going to be sounding a little Lucy in the Sky.
Tempos are all going to be a little slower this show.
Hey, what version of Cubase do you work on, Steve?
I think it's a 5.0.
VST then?
Yeah, VST.
On Macintosh?
No, I use PC.
Yeah, good man.
Miles, you have the new version, right?
The SX2.
Yeah. Oh, well, now they're up to SX.
Now they're up to 4.
4.2, yeah.
And they continue to do amazing stuff.
Yep.
They really do. They listen to customers. They really put in really, really useful features. I mean, Cubase now for scoring to picture is unbelievable. If you can have a very complex score with complex tempo changes and time signature changes and then get a picture change, and you can just, in 5 seconds with the mouse, you can warp your MIDI and your audio to match the picture changes. And whether you're dragging one MIDI track or 100 MIDI tracks and 100 audio tracks,
it would crash just the same.
It's really solid. It definitely makes my life easy.
It is. It's great. It's a great program.
So, Andrew, you going to the AM?
Yeah, I'll be going down. I'm not showing anything. I'm going to be wandering around looking.
You looking for anything in particular?
No, they're, well, yeah, basically, you know. My wife doesn't listen to the podcast, so I'm sorry.
Tell us,
Andrew,
what are you looking for?
all kinds of stuff. Just, I don't know, looking for compressors. That's my latest thing. And also I want to see some of the newer Chandler stuff, some of the germanium bass.
Have you heard
stuff.
That?
Used the germanium preamp, and it was amazing. And he's got an EQ based on the same circuit.
Wow.
Really? Because I've read a lot of really great things, and they're not that expensive either. They're like list of like, what, $12.50 or something?
Something like that. I don't know. It varies. Some of it can be kind of pricey, but it's really good stuff. So I want to check that out. And also Tonelux has a bunch of things coming out because they've got sort of a modular rack thing, and then of course there's API to see, and just everything. I'm just going to wander around until my ears ring, which should take about 12 minutes.
What about you, Scott? Are you going to NAMM?
Oh yeah, if there's gear, I gotta go to the temple, you know, and I gotta get my fix.
Are you looking for anything in particular?
Anything that does weird stuff. I mean, my favorite place in NAMM is the. All the way in the back, downstairs, in that little place with the mom-and-pop shops.
So you mean where I'm going to be?
There's always some really interesting stuff down there.
Is.
Oh.
Really?
Yeah. It's down in the dungeon. I want to be there. And usually you're by, like, the person that has that stick pole with the keyboards on it, and on the other side is
who's,
like the...
Who's been there, I think, for 28 consecutive NAMMs and never sold a product.
Just the front.
Perseverance. Well, I think it just has to sell one, though, because it's $80,000.
But sometimes you go to NAMM because this is the only time you get to see people at NAMM. I mean, there's certain people you only see at NAMM.
Right.
So you just go to NAMM and it's the schmooze fest.
Oh, NAMM's a great place. I mean, for the longest time, that's the only time I saw Rob was at NAMM.
Yeah.
You know, like once a year I could see Rob. We'd go out to dinner because we have mutual friends together, and that was it. That was the.
So you come and crash in his rooms.
No, but NAMM's a really, really a good place to.
I also forgot to mention one thing, and I shouldn't have forgotten with Marvin sitting here with us. But I'm going to be hanging out at Apex a bit at the show too, because I've been using a bunch of their stuff recently. But also, we just used their stuff to record a concert around Christmas, and we used the new Anaconda, which is the 64 channel. A fiber optic snake, and it was amazing. We had to record 96 channels, so we used two anacondas. Anaconday? What's the plural of anaconda?
Anacondi.
Anacondi. We used two of them, and it was just amazing. On basically two little pieces of dental floss, we were able to run 1,000 feet and do a 96 track recording, 48K 24-bit, and control all the mic pre's remotely over just these two tiny little fiber optic cables. So
hey, you know
I'm going to be hanging out talking about that.
Speaking of controlling the mic pre's, how do you control those mic pre's? Somebody asked me that.
Well, we use the 1788s, the Aphex ones. They're 8 channels each.
Right.
So we had 12 of them for 96 tracks. And then you can either use – they have a hardware remote that looks like the front panel of one of the 1788s, or you can use a computer.
What's the actual cable that plugs into the...
It's all over the one fiber optic. It can control all the mic pre's and send all the audio over just a tiny little fiber optic.
And then you pull out, like, on the other side, like a USB cable and plug it into your computer? Or how does that,
it's Ethernet.
Okay, Ethernet. That's what I wanted to know.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, we had to run 1,000 feet at the Universal Amphitheater. I guess it's called the Gibson Amphitheater now.
Is it really?
Yeah.
They changed it?
They changed it.
Excuse me, my voice is still changing.
That's okay.
A little excited there, wouldn't it?
But, we had to run 1,000 feet, and instead of, well, when we've recorded these shows in the past, we've run gigantic 6-inch bundles of cable, and we could never go more than a couple hundred feet. And this, we ran 1,000 feet, and it just took about 20 minutes to snake it all the way around the amphitheater, and teardown took about 10 minutes.
Wow.
And it was amazing. It sounded great, and we recorded 6 hours, and there were no dropouts or glitches or anything. It was incredible.
How are you feeling, by the way? You're sounding okay with the Vicodin, so...
I may be sounding okay, but I'm suffering for our craft, I must say that.
Hey, Bobby, you going to the NAMM show?
I'm
going to
try, yeah, definitely. And when does it start, Wednesday? No,
we can't.
Thursday,
and we've got football, can't...
Yeah, we play soccer. No. We're the English over here. We've got to play soccer. Well, I think it's in a way.
No, definitely. We must have got a page. We all went. When you all three of us went down there?
We did, didn't we? That's how we met. Year.
Well, that's how I met Bobby, was over at the NAMM.
Yeah, I saw Martin there last year.
That's right. And first time we've
met. That's where we met.
Yeah. See, the NAMM show. The NAMM show. If you've never been to the NAMM show. Steve, you ever been to the NAMM show?
Sure.
Are you going this year?
I don't know.
Oh, you don't play,
I'm not sure. I'm looking for a ticket, actually.
Oh, hey. Well, we'll talk afterwards. All right. Well, see, I had to talk about the NAMM show because this is our NAMM spectacular. But obviously, the NAMM show is probably going to be a lot better after the NAMM show when we have our stories from the NAMM show. So we'll revisit it. Hey, one thing I wanted to talk about on this podcast Steve wrote a really interesting article in Bass Player magazine about 10 years ago, maybe 7 years ago, 8 years ago.
Yeah, I guess about 7 years ago.
And I wanted to bring this up and see what you guys thought about this. But the name of the article was Music as a Life Form. And we're going to get a little cerebral here with music. But Steve, why don't you just give us a little paraphrase of the article and what you were saying in it. Because it's really interesting. I read it one time, but it just kind of stuck with me, and we had a conversation when I saw him, and it's just, well, go ahead, I'm not going to say anything.
Okay. Yeah, when I was there, I was exposed to this different way of looking at music and some of their older musical cultures.
Why don't you tell them where you were?
Oh, this was in Niamey, Niger, in West Africa. I spent about 2.5 years traveling around West Africa after I got out of college studying different instruments, and it was a really wonderful perspective on music, basically, as opposed to them thinking of it as something that people do, talented people do. They think of it as a being, a huge being that spans the universe and all time and uses us in its life and with a being just like we are, with a will and a volition all of its own, that's this big, huge, eternal being that occasionally calls on someone to play music, and you can react to that however you want, whether you feel blessed or not blessed. But it produces a music culture where you'll see a lot of people who don't take it in the same way that people in a commercialized music culture take it. This was in the 1970s, by the way. When I was there, a lot of people had never heard a tape recorder. A lot of the people who I recorded had never heard themselves played back. So this was like music free of economics. And you would find plenty of situations where a person would be playing an instrument, a complete virtuoso, and then he might just pass it on to the next person who would pick it up and play exactly like he did, just passing around instruments, and everyone seems to be able to play them equally without any person taking credit for being the originator of the talent or the thing that makes it do it. It's more that you're called on to be useful to this huge being, you know, and so they take it that way. And a lot of times when, say, someone isn't called on, like they're not feeling it, rather than trying to force it or saying, here, I'm a professional, you know, I've got a gig here, I got to play, they just take it as a cue for their break. And this is great. Music doesn't need me right now. So it's a a different way of looking at it.
I found that fascinating because think about music. There's few things in life that can elicit the emotions that music can do, whether it's you want to dance or you want to sing or you want to cry. And, I mean, have you guys ever thought, like, what is that? How does that music, how do those notes, how do they make you feel that way? I mean, have you ever been in a situation where you've heard something maybe for the first time and it just struck you as, like, the most incredible thing, you know? And
there's a wonderful book out at the moment which I'm reading, which is called Your Brain on Music. And it's an amazing book written by a person who is a musician but also studied the brain in a scientific way. And what is an amazing thing to think about is how we all have in us the sense of keys, the sense of notes that sound right without any training. We know what, you know, most people walking down the street can listen to a song and know if it's going in tune or out of tune without any training. Or if somebody starts singing Happy Birthday in a certain key, everybody will start singing in that same key. And this is without any, if you think about it, any of the training that we go through. Which is, and it's really a great book to read because it's looking at the way music is already in us. It's already there without, as you know, too much training. We can hear a hymn at Christmas and most people will remember it quickly any training.
Right.
They'll remember folk songs straight away. Just thinking about that, and here we are as professional players and musicians and we've been trained to a certain degree. But just to stop and go back to the rudiments and say there's something that's actually in us from the moment we're born. And I recommend it. So it's just such an interesting book because it's looking at the perspective of music through science and also through emotions. So, you know, when you think of the rudimentary training we have from without knowing how we have it, it's pretty phenomenal.
Well, you know, it makes me wonder, like Andrew, when you're mixing, you know, do you ever mix and just – as you're mixing, you just want to get like a certain emotion, and you know, it's less technical, but more like boom, it's hitting you.
Yeah,
in that spot.
Definitely. I mean, it's easier, obviously, at the beginning of the process when you're working on the song or trying to get a performance. But even while mixing, definitely, you get to a transition in a song, and very early in the mix, you get to a point where you get goosebumps or the hairs stand up, and you're like, okay, that's something we've got to keep. And sometimes, 3 hours later, you've fixed all the other problems in the mix, and all of a sudden that's gone away, and you realize, well, you know, I'll go break some things to get that back because that's what people will remember. And it's – I was also reading something recently. I can't remember exactly where it was, but it was a writer talking about in response to some praise he had gotten for writing, being able to elicit all these emotions. He said, well, but that's nothing compared to someone who can compose to elicit a response because it's so abstract. It's not necessarily easy, but you can at least look at words on a page and understand why it might make you feel in a certain way or why a picture or a movie would. But that musically, there's no explanation really as to why something could make you sad or hopeful or happy or any of that coming from music. And definitely while mixing, if you find something that starts to give you a bit of that emotion, you've got to go after it, because that's why people like things.
Yeah, because I find sometimes I get so wrapped up in the technology that I lose, like if I'm mixing, I'm so far away from the emotion. And you know, last time on the podcast, we were talking about things that people wanted to do this year, and mine was, you know, more projects of passion. And so I went in back and, you know, I revisited some sessions that I did, and I found, you know, myself doing the same thing when I was recording it. I had like a drum loop and it was too much. And I pulled all that stuff out and I just concentrated on just the guitar and the vocal on a really emotional level. And the results were that I was just, it just hit me emotionally. And I think this year, you know, if there was one piece of advice that I would give people would be to start plug it into the emotion, to start plug it into that thing that helps, you know, helps you feel certain ways at certain times in music, whatever that is.
I think something that we in the computer age of doing music get really stuck on is this whole thing where the music is abstract and elicits emotion. We don't pay any attention to that part of the music because we now actually have a visual representation, whether it be the MIDI notes or the notation or the waveforms. And you spend so much time looking at that while you're working on the music that I don't know how often you really get yourself away from that and just listen. which is how anybody else is ever going to experience the music. And I think the best thing about putting a console in my studio is I no longer have a computer in front of me. It's off to the side. So anytime I'm listening, I can't look. And whenever I would be mixing in Pro Tools, of course you look. You're like, oh, I'm going to ride that vocal, but oh, I can see it's going to get loud up here. And you kind of know what you're doing beforehand without actually listening. And to get back to the point of just pure listening takes – it's great and it's hard to do, but it's also – it's a lot like when I was playing trumpet in high school and in college and being a musician where you're just reacting to what you're hearing as opposed to all of the little things you can do to distract yourself from it.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Scott, when you're doing feature films? I mean, it's the sound effects. It's all emotion,
well,
you know?
I mean, and forgetting just normal sound effects, but sound design, which is different.
Right.
Because one of the things I'm doing right now, which is kind of fun, Wolfgang Peterson has hired us to do the director's cut for Troy. And one of the things I'm doing right now is I'm using sounds to create intimidation. So what I do is it's all about emotion, and it's all about telling a story and making people happy, sad, or whatever. So in this one thing I'm working on right now, there's several points in the movie where you've got to get the sense that there's, 50,000 soldiers. So one of the things they do is they're throwing these fireballs down. These are the soldiers of Troy. So what they did, and I took all these recordings of shield hits and grunts and chants and different speakers. So they go, and we're talking like a mile long of this with this low end. And I play rhythm games, go, and all the soldiers look up like, what was that? Was it thunder? Hila whispers. And it keeps going faster and faster and faster until the arrows start shooting out, the fireballs going. So this is something that is very rhythmical. And it falls under sound design because all the music's doing at that point is sustaining. But the sustain doesn't really add any tension. So what I'm doing now is taking all these pitch types of grunts that I ended up creating in, six channels and sub rumbles. And it's very, effective. So it's been kind of fun that way.
When you do sound design, do you have certain frequencies or certain sounds that you know can take an emotion a certain way? I mean, do you know?
Well, intimidation, anything dark tends to be on the lower side. What's happening also as they're hitting, I'm adding sub rumble and it's getting louder and louder. So it's becoming not oral, but also physical that when you finally release it and you stop that, you feel elated and you feel lighter. So there's a lot of tricks with frequencies to be able to accomplish emotional, storytelling, and whether you do something light, airy. I find that also everybody has internal rhythm. So if you start going, or go, and you start doing these random rhythms, it makes people feel uncomfortable. So what I do is I look at a scene and I start pacing out a scene and figuring out whether it's normal footsteps. What is showing the scene? How do I use sounds to be able to subliminally or not subliminally just start, tweaking people's emotional buttons?
This is one thing relating back to the African situation as well. In this book, Your Brain on Music, the use of rhythm being so important. If we go back to prehistoric times, and we even see drawings in the French caves of they're hitting things. They've got drums and they're into rhythm right from the beginning, and it's such an integral part of music. And as you say, emotional, even in movies, because we've got this internal rhythm. And at the beginning of time, Neanderthal man would communicate by rhythm.
And it's also taking sound, and you have to open up your definition of music, because music's more than just guitars and strings.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, the best analysis, even in the spoken voice, was The Shining, which we studied. And when you hear Jack Nicholson, the guy's talking to him, and the way he answers him is totally out of rhythm to what the guy is asking the question. So he's taking a scene that's pacing, and he's totally screwing with the pace of the scene, which is the internal rhythm that most people don't even know that's there. And when you do that, it makes people feel very uncomfortable.
One of the things that I learned a couple of years ago that just completely blew my mind, there was an article in Nature magazine about
your mind on music. And they said that your brain realizes music analog. There's no digital code that comes from the oral cortex to the brain. In fact, when you're hearing an A440, the synapses that are realizing that A are actually firing 440 times a second. And if I play that on my bass and bend the string up, just like I'm tightening the string and raising the frequency, I'm increasing the frequency of your synaptic firings. So just like the Africans believe that they don't buy and sell instruments traditionally, they have to be given away because they believe they're living things that are brought to life by, in a similar way that we're brought to life by something else. We really are instruments, and the things that we call instruments are the activators of this instrument. Huh. Because what you hear, based on, according to this article, based on your degree of mental plasticity, which they say audiophiles and musicians have the greatest amount of, that's what determines how many frequencies you can track at a given moment. So when you're sitting back there and you're listening to your mix and you're hearing every single note and all the nuances and all the hairs on the backs of the notes, you're using that mental plasticity, and different parts of your brain are actually playing all of those notes. When you play music for a human being, it's just like raising the top of a piano and yelling into it. And the sympathy of the strings from that voice, that's what happens when music happens in our heads. And so people who are tone deaf have the mental equivalent of heart arrhythmia, to where their brain is incapable of sustaining a constant firing at a steady frequency. So when you sing them a pitch, it sounds like it's wavering. And so that's why they can't manage to match a pitch. But I was completely blown away because I didn't know, but I assumed that there was some sort of, you know, code that took it from an analog signal into something our brains appreciated. I had no idea that our brains were actually creating the music in real time.
Wow.
Oh, the second part of this podcast. That's the first
part. That's, okay, that's perhaps the deepest moment we've ever had.
Ever had.
Isn't that amazing?
But that is amazing. When you, I mean, my brain is exploding because it's just...
Your brain is the instrument.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Well, let me... Miles, you know, with the Arabic music, I'm so unfamiliar with Arabic music. Is there, you know... I'm sure they have the same emotional... pads or choruses or musical phrases, then, I mean, how's the emotion factor in Arabic music?
Well, it's very interesting. And in regards to the book that was mentioned earlier as well, first of all, I guess I should say there's so much Arabic music. To say Arabic music is almost like saying Western music.
Exactly.
So you kind of have to look at something more exact. But I think what you're getting at is, of course, most people know that Eastern music traditions have different scales and different intonation and tuning right. systems. And when you were referring earlier to the way somebody who's heard a hymn can just kind of sing it back in tune naturally out of their own ears, I was thinking, well, is that something that's pre-programmed in the brain or something that's learned as a child growing up hearing Christmas carolers every year come to your door or this or that? And it's funny because in Egypt, those microtones, those out-of-tune notes, as we say here, like usually it's the third or the seventh or the second, are so common in the culture outside of the musical realm, it's like foundational to the aesthetic and to that emotion. And so the same scale that, say, a muezzin, somebody who reads the call to prayer from the mosque, he'll sing, or rather speak, the call to prayer in the same scale that somebody's singing it in a pop song on the street, in the same scale that somebody's selling oranges and watermelons, singing a little tune to get people to come out and buy their fruit. So these notes have a cultural significance that goes far deeper than you might just think a musical aesthetic. It's like a cultural sonic aesthetic or something. And it makes you wonder, does it come from in the brain, or is it something that's just absorbed at a young age and becomes your musical language, you know?
I think in the book I'm reading, they're saying it is absorbed about your culture. You hear it quite early on. Yeah. You start to feel this around the family, around, hence Western music, the scales. We're hearing it as we grow up, and we're hearing our mothers and our fathers sing certain things. So interesting, though, that what you're mentioning, because in medieval times, you weren't allowed to sing a fourth. You know, it was a bad note. It was an evil note. It was
a tritone, right?
Yeah,
note.
It was a dark
note.
Devil's note. Devil's fourth. So it's, but what you were just mentioning there, according to the book, they're leaning towards saying, you know, the moment you come out of the womb, what you're surrounded by, you're hearing, even when you're in the womb, you'll be sensing the culture you're living in.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you a funny story talking about, I produced a record for Chef Mami, and he sent me his mini demos, and I was sitting there with my keyboard going, man, what notes are these guys playing? I couldn't work out the thing until I eventually
realize that to tune the scale, you know, my chromatic scale of my keyboard, I had to do half-tone shifts, quarter-tone shifts rather. But I couldn't at first. I was sitting there like a complete gorilla going, doi, 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 doi.
It slips by your mind. You can't even hear those notes at first. They're just, wait, something's different. And
it's like us singing a blues scale or something so simple for us. These guys sing it, and he's like, man, these guys' ears are so sharp.
And the intonation of those quarter tones are super regional, too. You find in the north of Egypt, they sing their third much sharper than in the south. And the first time somebody told me this, I mean, I was just trying to hear it. Yeah. Let alone hear a difference between the two. And it comes after a long period of time. I mean, just now I feel that I can hear and maybe even sing a little bit of that quarter tone. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, it's something that I think through osmosis, through your ears.
Sure.
It's a point of set of language, and I think that's exactly it. Yeah. When you do get used to, you know, sound as a language.
Yeah, yeah.
What was that you were telling me about, that sharp third being the origins of what we call the blue note?
Interesting.
Oh. Well, I don't know if I was the one telling you that, actually, but I do have a theory.
That African musicians trying to achieve that sharp third would blur the note between the minor and the major third.
Well, yeah, I think it's just kind of an interesting parallel to draw, to notice that in Arabic music traditions, not so much, I think, in West African or Central African, but in Arabic music traditions, which came all the way over the north of Africa to Morocco, this intonation and tuning system had a quarter tone third. And so it's kind of interesting that 100 years later, maybe black communities in the south were then playing these blues notes, mixing the minor and the major third. I mean, you could use your imagination and draw a parallel there for sure.
Wow.
See, yeah, especially with the slaves being brought across. So you can imagine.
The communities are being transplanted. Yeah. Being brought, they're community diaspora, so reproducing on fretted guitars, the best of what their cultural ears remember.
Do you know, Steve, if your article is on the web? Have you found it on the web? Do you know if the bass player?
I think it is in the bass player archives. It was, I think, January of 2000, or maybe it was 2001. Music as a life form. It was a section they call Soapbox.
Yeah. Well, I just want to encourage everybody out there to go on Bass Player, the website, to look up that article, because really it's gonna change the way you feel about music, the way you feel about sound in general. And I think if there's one piece of advice that I want to follow myself, is I want to plug into the emotional part of music a little bit more. And I think when people say, hey, you know, a lot of the pop music is crap, you know, I think a lot of that music is just lost its soul, you know. I think it's lost its emotion. So anyhow,
it can happen. Oh, by the way, that article is also on my website. There's a copy of it.
Oh, what's your website?
StephenJ.com with a PH.
StephenJ.com. www.StephenJ.com.
It's interesting, Mike, when you said just about soul being lost, and the show we're talking about with technology, I think a lot of the technology has taken a lot of the soul out.
I mean, I think it's important as we go to the NAMM show. That's why I brought that up before we talked about this, is just remember that, you know, no matter how many flashing lights or whatever the gears and gizmos are, you know, it all comes down to the emotion.
I'm going there for the chicks, I tell you.
the gizmos are so amazing now. They have a soul of their own. You know,
but I think a lot of it does come back to you start taking visual cues for what you're hearing. Yeah. And then you stop paying attention to what you're hearing because you just go by the visual cues.
But I also think songs...
Ears only.
But I also think songs and music become life signatures, where what happens is you hear something that you may have thought sucked at the time. 20 years later, you hear it, and you're getting a flash of all those things that were happening that were defining that point of your life.
Mm.
So even though, you know, sometimes we go, oh, man, the stuff in this era, it had a lot more soul, it may also be that a lot of that stuff in that era brought a lot of emotions that, you know, of what was happening in your life at that time. I mean, because, you know... Some 80s music just goes into eighths, and it's like, you're like, whatever, you know? But then all of a sudden you hear it back, and you go, oh, God, I remember that time.
Yeah. Well, the one thing that just technology and emotion just really, you know, hit the perfect point for me is with pads. It seems like pads are just getting more lush. You know, you go up to some of the keyboards and you just play a simple chord, and it's going to make you cry right there because the pads are so lush. The other thing, too, is what was that... that you just got, the Waves guitar rig or the Waves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Use that, the pedal board, the distortion with like a bagpipe.
Yeah,
there's a distortion cool. and some reverb. I mean, come on, that's just total longing right there. I mean, come on, we can all hear it in our head. Well, thank you very much for coming, Steve. It was great.
And hey, thanks for inviting us.
Hey, and Miles, you know.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And you know, we're gonna keep in touch with you as you go on the. On the road, and you know, give us little updates as to where you are, and I'll pop it up on the website. You know,
all right, be happy to.
Steve's in Australia now, and we're not.
Good eye, Bruce.
All right, and Marvin, thank you very much for you know, sponsoring the podcast and for being with us. And you're going to be at the NAMM show?
Absolutely.
And we also want to introduce before we go. The Audio Nowcast now has a new producer.
Yay!
Her name is April. You want to pronounce your last name, April?
Mastropaolo.
Wow.
And cool.
That's a serious name.
And she, yeah, so it's obviously going to be...
organized now.
So, Faye, we want to welcome April on board, and Andrew.
And we'll put in a GPS in Bobby so we can see where he is at any given time. Where is Bobby? Oh, we see him in Van Nuys.
We track him, bring him in.
No name.
All I know, if we all keep showing up, we're going to need a bigger table.
Yeah, it's true.
All right, well, I just want to encourage everybody, if you have any questions for any of the panel members or you just want to drop us a note, you can always reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's www.audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And we're also going to be giving away a Korg D2 drum machine. That's our next giveaway.
Talking about soul.
Hey, by the way,
speaking
of giveaways, how's the DMP7s going?
Great.
Did you get one?
And with each DMP7 comes a tooth.
And a Vicodin. We'll talk later.
Hey, we give away free gear. We never said in a timely fashion.
Well, the first DMP7 will be finding its rightful owner quite shortly, actually. As soon as the medicine wears off.
All right. Well, hey, this is Mike Rodriguez for the Audio Nowcast. For Rob,
hello.
Andrew, Martin,
hello.
Bobby,
hello.
And Scott. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbiter, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaolo and uses Apex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.